Live from Los Angeles, this is LA Talk Radio, broadcasting for the seventh year.
You're listening to All About Guitar with Jeff Lolo, only on LA Talk Radio.
Amazing instrument. It has developed into an incredible voice in today's music. So many types of guitars, so many styles of playing, all sorts of gear. How does one make their voice be heard as a guitarist? My name is Jeff Floro, and welcome to All About Guitar, where we talk tone, we talk technique, we talk gear. Where we discover how we can become better musicians in a world of constantly changing technologies. Where we take a good look at everything guitar. And sometimes not exactly guitar, but just as important. So we can be more successful as a musician in today's music scene. So sit back and relax, and let's explore All About Guitar. The Hoff is not here, but we have better than that. We have the man that actually scored all of the shows for Knight Rider. He did all of the orchestrations for all the cues and everything. But there's more to this man. I'm really honored to have Don Peek with me today. And he started out as a teenager playing for the Everly Brothers. But there's some other interesting things that he did. He was part of the Wrecking Crew, played on with Phil some of the sessions for Phil Spector, especially one of my favorites, the Righteous Brothers, You Lost That Loving Feeling. And he also was the, I'm just giving you a brief summary, but he was the staff guitarist for Motown, played on all the Jackson 5, played on a bunch of stuff, the big hits of the Supremes and Smokey Robinson, the Commodores, the Temptations. And he's an amazing session musician, but also too, like he did, he got into film scoring and arranging. He arranged, when I was doing the research, I was really blown away by this. He did the arrangement for If I Had a Hammer for Bobby Darin.
If I Were a Carpenter.
If I Had a Carpenter, I'm sorry. But anyway, that Bobby Darin song is a classic, but a great arrangement.
Thank you.
And, so he's done a lot of different things as an arranger, as a guitarist, as a composer. Welcome to the show. I don't know where to start, but let's start from the beginning. Your session work, how you started, because you've had a pretty interesting background. Your training, who taught you and stuff like that. Let's just take it from there.
Thank you. I'm honored to be here. I appreciate you having me here. This is, first of all, the music you played at the beginning, which I know some of is yours, is wonderful.
Thank you very much.
And I want to make it very clear to the audience that that guy was playing really fast before. That was not me. I am not a shredder. So, you know, I started late. I was in high school, mm-hmm. at the end of high school, and I went up to camp, summer camp, and some of the guys were playing the guitar, and I was fascinated with it. They knew how to put their fingers on these instruments, and I mm-hmm. said, guys, this is amazing. So they gave me a ukulele and said, look, Peek, go out in the woods and practice, come back later. Mm-hmm. So by the time I came back from camp, which was Camp Hess Kramer, of course, I was playing. And I noticed in high school, all of a sudden, that there were female people who were paying attention to me for the first time. Because I was a nerd. I was a math science guy. And suddenly, I was like, hmm. So I sold my motorbike and got a guitar. It was a plank. It was made by Kay, which was a Sears and Roebuck, flat piece of wood. It was bright green. It didn't have a strap, so I had a piece of rope, which I had tied around the bottom and came around and tied on the neck. And I started playing, and lo and behold, someone in the a cappella choir needed an accompanist, and her name was Stephanie Rosner, and I ended up on a Coca-Cola show called Spotlight on Youth, playing this guitar. It's on my website. You can see me playing, and that was the beginning. I got a job. My cousin Richard had a tape recorder. No one had a tape recorder in those days. And there was a guy who came over and rehearsed, and he had three girls, and they were doing the I don't know if this volume's enough. Is that too much?
That's good.
It's a little
good.
Bit loud for me.
Okay, I can bring it down.
If you don't mind. So this was a very complicated song, and it had C, and it had A minor, and it had F, and it had G, and these chords I knew, so I was in great shape. So I would play along, and Tony Casanova, well, he started telling everybody I was a genius. It was all over Los Angeles that Don Peake was this great guitarist. Well, please, you know. So now I started learning songs. And I learned Bebopalula. Mm-hmm. And luckily, in the key of A, you have the open A string, and then you have the E, so you can go... Carol Kay is laughing right now because she always laughs about that. Anyway, so Tony Casanova told this club owner that he had to audition me for Jackie Lee Cochran. Jackie Lee Cochran was a rockabilly with huge sideburns, a shirt with leather tassels on it. And there was a club in the valley called the Rag Doll. Now it is something else. It's at the corner of Lancashire, and I guess it's Oxnard. Anyway, so I go out there. And there's a line of guitar players lined up to go in the door. Each of us had their guitar, and inside there was an amplifier. And there was a man with a cigar, obviously the manager. His name was George. And we kept waiting for our turns, and finally it was my turn. And I came in, and George said, "Do you know Bebopalula?" And I said, "Do I?" And he said, "Oh, my God, hire this kid. He's hot." So they hired me. And nobody knew that was the only song that I knew. So opening night comes, and the band is all out there. These are grown-up guys. These are, like, serious musicians, jazz guys. And there's me and Jackie Lee Cochran, who stood about 4'6". And we did Bebopalula, and I played the shit out of it. I played Bebopalula like it's never been played before. and then Jackie takes his bow, and he gets off the stage, and now the band looks at me, and I look at them, and they were like, "Okay, what do you want to do?" And I was like, I don't know. So they took off and played something, and they started writing out charts for me and handing them to me, and I went home. And I thought, man, I got to practice. I got to figure this out. And there was a chord. I knew how to play C, you know. Like, but this said C major 7th. And I thought, ooh, C major 7th. So I noticed up on La Brea, there was a school, a music school. It was a white building that said Clara Joyce Sherman School of Music. So my mother drove me over there. And Ray Polman was teaching there with this guitar, this 1949 Gibson 250 that I have had since 1958. And Ray Polman said, "Well, if you do this, it's C major 7th. And so this was a huge revelation to me. I was like, "Oh, my gosh." So now I went back to the club, and the guys in the band are going, Well, we were fired after 2 weeks and thrown out of there. But in the meantime, I had gotten this reputation. And we would go out at night after the show, and there was a place to eat, and then, you know, there was a jam session in the valley at this place called the Sun Valley Rancho. And it was way up on San Fernando Road where Sunland Boulevard, Vineland becomes Sunland if you go north. And there was this guy with really long sideburns. Everybody had sideburns. So there was this guy who was singing in there, Lance LeGault. And he was Elvis's stand-in in the movies. And Lance, I started playing, and Lance said, listen, I'm starting at the Crossbow over on Van Nuys Boulevard. Will you play for me? So I joined Lance and the Dynamics. Mm-hmm. And Elvis would come in like 2-3 times a week, and he would go up in the balcony with Dorsey Burnett and Johnny Burnett, and we'd play our set, you know. And by this time, I could play. I had 4 chords, and I could play like C major 7th, and I could play, I don't know, I could play D. And I was getting very advanced, and so now, excuse me, no laughing in the gallery there. That was Laurie, and Elvis would come in and he'd say, "Hello, Don." And we'd go sit up on the balcony with Elvis. And James Burton, of course, would start to play with Elvis. And he was a lovely man, Elvis. Anyhow, so I played with Lance. And Lance was a huge Ray Charles fan. Mm-hmm. And so he had a saxophone player named Chuck Blalack. Mm-hmm. And Chuck transcribed all the Ray Charles pieces perfectly. So, you know, in a... You know, Hallelujah, Lover. So I learned these songs the right way, and this will come up later in the story. So, you know, we played with Lance, we had a good time, and the Everly Brothers were looking for a guitarist, and they sent over Marshall Lieb, who was one of the Teddy Bears with Phil Spector. Mm-hmm. And Marshall said, "Listen, Don, the Everlys would like to audition you." And I said, "Man, I've only been playing a while." And he said, "Listen, we need you to come over and audition." And they needed someone that could read music, and by this time I was playing at LA City College in the dance band. They needed someone who could play the Everly songs, and they needed someone, you know, was available to go on the road. And so, you know, this is what we did. So we did Wake Up Little Susie. I played for the Everlys. They liked me. They hired me. By this time, I was 21. Flew me to England. And it was amazing. And I said to Joey Page, the band leader, I said, "Joey, man, did I get the job?" He said, "Don, you're on the airplane. You got the job." It's okay. I didn't mean to squelch you. I like your laughter. I didn't mean to be. Okay. So now we're playing with the Everlys. And I was so excited. And I was so excited to hear. My mother was born in England, but she'd been raised in Canada. She didn't have much of an accent. And I was so excited to speak to some English people. And they put us into the Strand Palace Hotel, and right on Trafalgar Square, in a really big room, a huge bathtub. I mean, it was heaven. And I remember I wanted to talk to English people. And I came down the stairs, and I walked out on and here was a Cockney couple in the gutter having an argument. Face to face, nose to nose, toe to toe. And the first thing I heard in England was, "Fuck off, fuck off, fuck off." And this was their argument in the middle of Trafalgar Square. So that was my experience. And we toured England. We had a great time.
What year was this?
1961.
Oh, okay.
And we took us up to Glasgow. I remember Glasgow because Glasgow, it's actually a little sharp. Why didn't you say so? It's tough when you have guitarists in the room with you. The thing about Glasgow was that these folks spoke with an accent that I had never heard before, and I had no idea what they were saying. We played the show, and they loved us. Now we're at the pub, and these fellas are coming up, and they're talking, and they're bumping with each other and drinking pints. And this fella came up to me, and he was going on, and I had no idea what he was saying. But I kept watching his right hand. I figured if he made a fist, that wasn't good. So I kept my eyes open, but nobody wanted to fight. They just thought we were cool. And so now we go back to the U.S. We toured the United States. And then we went back to England. This was 1962.
Okay.
The height of the Everlys' career. We're on a show with Bo Diddley, Little Richard. We got the Everlys. We got the Rolling Stones.
Oh, wow.
We have the Verners Girls. We have Frank Ifield. You remember when he was singing, "I Remember You"? Mm-hmm. And it was stunning. And I started noticing these guys with long hair, longer than yours. And they were backstage, and I said, who are those guys? And they said, those are the Beatles. They're friends of the Rolling Stones, and they love the Everly Brothers. They love the harmonies.
That's right.
And so we started traveling around. The Beatles were traveling with us. So we went to Germany. We went to Hamburg, to the Star Club in the Reeperbahn, which is the red light district. And it was amazing. We had sets. They were three little stages, and it was the Everly Brothers, the Beatles, and the Rolling Stones, and we traded sets with each other. And we had the best time.
Now, was that back when they were more or less doing covers, or were they doing their original stuff?
They were starting to do original stuff. It was 1962. And of course, they were doing covers. And the Stones were doing their songs. And they were watching Little Richard. Mm-hmm. And they were watching. And the Beatles, you know, the Everlys started doing, you know. I'm going to have to do this one. Yeah, so it was a. So they started doing Lucille. So we were learning from each other. And Bo Diddley, of course, you know. I'm going to turn this on here. And, you know, it was a. So we had Bo Diddley. And, of course, Richard, what a pianist. Oh, my gosh.
Oh, yeah.
I was a little stunned one evening. We were standing on the side of the stage at the London Palladium. And, you know, the curtains are gigantic, and they go very, very high because it's a real theater. They had scenery that would come down. And I looked across the stage, and there was this strange glowing figure in the side lights. And it was a man wearing a negligee holding a Bible. And I realized it was Little Richard who was standing over there. And it was a little revelatory for me.
Let me ask you something. When you were in England, what were they playing? Because what was the music scene at the time? Because this is before, I presume, the whole Mercy Beat and all that stuff, they hadn't broken yet. So what was being played on the radio? Do you remember?
I do not recall.
Okay. I mean, obviously, the Everly Brothers were a big thing.
A lot
of the American groups.
Yeah.
But it must have been interesting because you were there at the beginning of that whole scene. It didn't form yet.
Right.
What were the Stones like back then? Were they doing covers or were they doing originals?
They were doing some originals. In fact, there's an article on my website where Keith says, I've been getting all these pointers from Don Peake. He's such a great guitarist and showing me some tricks. And this was Melody Maker magazine, 1962. But I want to go back to the United States.
Okay.
Because now we're in Oklahoma, and it's hot. It's hot. It's hot. We're outdoors. The deck is the floor. I still say deck from the service. Was black. And we're out on the stage, and it's hot. And the deck is hot. And we're like back on our heels trying to just. And we're playing along. And now evening comes, and they turn on these gigantic Klieg lights. And every bug in Oklahoma starts swirling around these lights. I mean, it's unbelievable. And we're doing Kathy's Clown. We're doing, you know. And I noticed something has landed on my guitar neck. And it's about an inch and a half long. And it has a stinger coming out of its nose. And it's alternating orange and black stripes. And it's heading down the guitar at the top of my guitar neck, and I'm here, I'm in G, right? And it's walking down my neck, and I'm thinking, what am I going to do now? So when it got to about A, I went, and I jumped up here, and I played the rest, and he kind of kept walking and walked off the guitar. But I'll never forget that. It was, like, extraordinary.
Hard lessons in changing your voicing and
yes,
guitar.
Voicings. Also, the Everly Brothers were sponsored by Gibson. Mm-hmm. And so I couldn't play my Fender Telecaster, you know, and I was panicking. And they handed me this red Gibson SG, the worst guitar on the face of the earth. This guitar had something wrong with the bridge, and it would break the fourth string or the third string during the concert. Because, you know, you're playing with the Everlys, you're playing that guitar.
Yeah.
And the audience got hip to it that I was going to break a string during the show.
Yeah.
And then they'd see it go boing, and it would stick over here. And I would have to figure out a voicing, whichever string was missing, and keep playing the show. It was crazy.
So you played electric and they played acoustic.
Yes, they played the big J200.
I'm surprised they didn't give you like an ES-335 or a Les Paul or something.
Well, of course, the Les Paul is a little heavy for me. But the 335, I don't even know if they existed then, did they?
In the 60s, yeah.
Really?
They were around. They came, I think one of the early ones was in the 50s.
Okay. Well, yeah, you're right. You're right. There was an early one. But they wanted me to play this SG to advertise it.
Yeah, they were probably just trying to, because they were really trying to push that.
And they had these strings that were made of iron. You could not bend this string if you tried. With three fingers, you couldn't bend the string. And here I was on stage trying to learn how to play this guitar. I mean, it was scary. But, you know, the Everlys were so magnificent.
That's when you first went there, you had the SG, or were you using a different guitar?
No, I actually did photographs of me with my Fender at the beginning in 61.
So which Fender did you have?
It was a 1951 Broadcaster. This is where everybody in the audience goes, because now it's worth, what, $150,000, $200,000?
Oh, easily.
You know, and it was a single pickup Broadcaster. It wasn't even a Telecaster. And I loved that guitar. I ended up playing with Sonny and Cher, you know, the I Got You, Babe, I'm the down, with the Telecaster.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that was...
Do you still have that guitar?
No, I unfortunately, in 1974, when I left Ray Charles, which is another story, I sold a bunch of guitars, and that guitar was one of them, because I didn't need them.
Did you use that with Ray Charles, the Tele?
No.
Okay.
No, with Ray Charles, I used this guitar, the Blondie, which is the ES... 250. I guess it's a 350.
Is that a 350?
Or a 250. I'm not sure.
The ones I'm looking on the internet, they show of the 250, some of them have, on a couple of them have the 2P
diamonds,
but a lot of them have the Charlie Christian.
Yes, the Charlie Christian. That's what Barney had, the Charlie Christian pickup. This must be a 250.
Let me see if the
1949.
There's a look at the 350 right now and see if I see anything different. Because that... it has that's a beautiful guitar. I got to try this thing before the show, and it looks the same, unless it's a little thinner. They're showing it has the parallelogram inlays
so
that he has here. So this, but I think both of them, the 250 has that too. So it's kind of hard to tell. It's really hard to tell which one's different and which one. So it could either be, we'll have to look at, I'll look in the F hole after the show and see what it is.
I don't think this has a label.
Oh, wow.
I want to tell you a story about Wes. Should I raise my mic? Because
I'm getting you, but let me bring it up. Go ahead. I'll lock it down.
Okay. So I'm going to college. I'm fascinated with Wes Montgomery. And this is a day when we didn't even have tape cassette yet. But my cousin had that reel-to-reel tape recorder, so I borrowed it, and I figured out a way to record myself playing rhythm guitar and make a loop. But it had to be like 3 minutes long. So I set it in my den at my parents' house in Las Palmas Avenue in Hancock Park, and I ran the tape out the door and around a chair and then around another chair and back into the tape recorder. So that's how I could make a tape loop.
Mm-hmm.
And I was practicing, and there was a thing that Wes did, you know, I would do. And I was playing. And this guitar in the background was in, which was me on the tape loop. And my father came home and he said, "What in the world is going on here?" And I said, "Don't touch the tape, please." But that's what you had to do.
Yeah. Now let me ask you, what was that, an Ampex deck?
I think it was, could have been a Wallensack.
I remember
tape
those.
Recorder. That would be more like it.
Okay, so that was even before, because later on you could do sound on some of those.
Now this was very basic. I think it was made for dictation. If you were a lawyer and you had a paralegal. I always thought a paralegal was someone who jumped out of an airplane with a briefcase, like D.B. Cooper. We should talk about D.B. Cooper.
Now you mentioned doing stuff with your own home recordings and stuff like that, and you worked with Jan and Dean.
Yes.
And I heard the early Jan and Dean, they used to record in somebody's garage. They actually, and those days there wasn't a lot of studios except except for the big labels.
Well, Armin Steiner had a studio on Formosa Avenue, and that's when some of the original Motown Los Angeles were recorded. And we, Lincoln Mayorga was playing piano, and we would go upstairs to the garage behind his mother's house, and Armin Steiner was the engineer.
Lincoln Mayorga played on the Motown. That's amazing.
Oh, that's esoteric.
We were talking about the Sheffield Lab things. Yeah. And he was doing like orchestral stuff and yeah. stuff later.
Yeah. Boy, so. I'm going to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, if you ever want to do something daunting, have someone start up a lathe recording a piece of vinyl and record six songs in a row without a mistake.
Yes.
For the whole band.
Let me explain to everybody what he's talking about. There was Sheffield Labs was famous for their direct-to-disc recordings. And back then, what they did is they would cut directly to the lathe. There was no tape. So it had the best frequency response and dynamic range because you could do a lot with a record. And early radio recordings and a lot of movie soundtracks were done on a lathe. They were cut to disc, and then they would move it to other medium as they needed it. And the trick was you had to do the whole side. It was like a 20-minute sides, or actually less. It was about 15 minutes. It wasn't until later that they would...
Yeah, because songs were about 2.5 minutes
long. Right, and you wanted enough room between the grooves. If you put it too close, it could jump and cause distortion. So what they would do is they would record like six songs in a row. And if you made a mistake, they had to start all over.
And throw it away.
Throw it away.
So let's go back to Knight Rider for a minute.
Okay.
You know, when I was hired to do Knight Rider, they wanted me to bring in synthesizers. Mm-hmm. And I had six players who would play. But that ostinato, that dang, digga, 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 that's actually Ralph Grierson playing live.
Wow.
He's such a good musician. Such a stunning musician. And I got to be so irritating because in this day, there was no call, you know, there was no caller ID. And mm-hmm. touch-tone phones had just come in. And I figured out how to play the ostinato on the touch-tone phone. So people would hear ding-a-ding-a-ding. They go, hello. And they'd hear ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding. And they'd say, Peak, cut it out.
Yeah. Do you remember what you used for that? That had a
That was a Super Jupiter.
Super Jupiter.
Yeah.
Now, in any time during Knight Rider, that riff, did you ever do that on guitar?
No.
It was
never,
always a keyboard.
Never. It was always,
a
keyboard. Yeah.
And that theme... Everybody knows that.
Oh,
this
yeah.
is great.
Yeah, and thank goodness that Stu Phillips heard Delibes' piece, which was called March of Bacchus. And if you get online and you listen to March of Bacchus by Delibe, you hear bum ba 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 bum ba 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 bum ba ba bum bum ba. Sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Mm. That's all I will say about that.
Well, just briefly, what was it like doing that must have been an interesting thing doing. You were doing all the underscore for all the shows.
Yeah, 20 minutes of original music every week, including doing the orchestrations and doing the timings because there were no computers.
That's right.
There was, you know, at the beginning there wasn't even a VCR. They'd bring it over on film.
So you had that book of all the timing codes, and then you would have to calculate.
Right, and that is the book. I just slipped my mind. Wait a second. Yeah, when you were a real composer, you would have this book with your name in gold on the front of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was all the calculations of what timing was for each beat at what tempo.
So they would, just to explain, what they would do is it would get me like, so if you knew that 3 seconds or whatever into the piece, there's, you know, somebody hits somebody and you got to hit that hit musically. So,
right.
So what he would do is he would put in his tempo and then he would calculate how many measures. And this book did all those calculations for him. And all the original composers, Goldsmith, Williams in the 50s and 60s. It's interesting because this was developed, I think, even in the 40s, they had all this stuff. And that book basically told you, okay, at bar 16 in, you know, on an eighth note after the third beat is where you have that hit.
Yeah, exactly. And that's when you add the 3-4 bar or the 5-4 bar or do whatever's necessary to move that bar line so that music will change.
Right.
With
and
the
at
film.
That time, were you recording, what, were you multi-tracking at that time?
Well, I wanted to point that out. I'm glad you said that. We recorded to 3-stripe magnetic film. Mm-hmm. There was no remix. There was no going back. You had your orchestra. You mixed it, while you were recording, while you were conducting, and it went right to film.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically a tape recorder except with sprockets.
Yeah.
And that's how we did it.
And that's how everything sank up. Now, you conducted?
I conducted.
Now, the interesting thing, this is before time code. There was no time code at that time. So you had what they called, what they did to the picture. He would be looking at the score on the podium, and on the picture they would punch holes into the film, the work print, and it flashes. And the guy that was like infamous for using this was Jerry Goldsmith. He had like really complex ones, and then they have like little streamlines to kind of warn you that this hit's coming. And so you did. They did all that.
You're slightly mistaken. Streamers and punches were a great tool, and Alfred Newman did it.
Yes, yes.
But by the time Knight Rider came along, we did have a click track running. So I could lock with a click track.
You did have a click track.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't mean to be argumentative.
No. But I mean, with Three Stripe Mag.
Yeah.
You didn't have a time code track like later with multi-track.
No, where they but the sprockets were locked. So you had the violins on one side, you had the percussion on the middle, you had mm-hmm. the strings. Excuse me, they had the strings, the brass, and the percussion.
Mm-hmm. And then just who were the main guys that you used at that time for your session guys? Who was your guitarist?
Well, it was 45 musicians on every session.
Wow.
And we had either Dean Parks, we had Dan Sawyer. Dennis Budimir was always there because there was something that I wrote. There was a do that Dennis would do. And so Lee Sklar came in a few times.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the time it was Ken Wilde on electric bass. We also had upright bass in the orchestra. I was one of the first people to hire female musicians. I had ladies playing saxophone. Oh. I had ladies playing trumpet. I said, you know, can you play? That was my criterion. Which brings me to my audition with Ray Charles.
Mm.
When I was at the studio at Gold Star. Now, Gold Star was where we did Phil Spector. We did a lot of the hits there. Barry White, I played on a lot of his original tracks there. But one day, Arthur Wright, standing in the hallway talking mm-hmm. on the telephone, I walk by and he says, hey, Don, take this call. And I said, what? He said, Ray Charles looking for a guitar player. And I said, well, I'm White. And he said, Don, take the call. So I took the telephone. It was one with the armored cable, you know, the payphone. And I said, hello, this is Don Peake. And a voice said, this is Joe Adams. Ray Charles looking for a guitar player. And I said, Joe, I'm White. He said, can you play? I said, yes. He said, we have gone through 35 guitar players. We cannot find somebody that can read music,
mm-hmm.
can play jazz, can play the blues, and knows Ray Charles' old songs. And I said, I can do all that. He said, get down here. So I get this guitar, my Blondie. I had a rhythm guitar with me and an amplifier. I drove down Western Avenue. I turned east on Washington Boulevard. And I'm driving along and looking on the left side. And there's this kind of semi-round building, obviously, RPM International.
Mm-hmm.
So I pull in there, and the back door has a buzzer. I push the button. Thing goes beep. I open the door. There's a stairway going up. I'm carrying my stuff up the stairs. At the top are two doors with push bars. And I took my right foot and bang, I kicked the door. Door flew open, and facing me in their chairs was the entire Ray Charles Orchestra and the Raylettes staring at me. Four trumpets, four trombones, five saxes, you know, David Fathead Newman, James Clay, Leroy Cooper, Philip Gilbo from Count Basie's band playing,
mm-hmm.
Juan Teasel from Ellington's orchestra playing trombone, the best of the best of the best, and there's an empty chair. I figured, uh-huh, that must be the guitar chair. So I walk over there, and I open up the book, and then the drummer goes, number 101. So I open up number 101, four pages, F9th... /... Then it says B#7... /... So I'm going, Count Basie style. So I get out my rhythm guitar, and I'm going to do this for you. I'm going to play like 24 bars. I'm just going to use this mic.
Okay, that's
because
fine.
I don't want to be too loud. So here's 24 bars of what we call Count Basie style blues. One, two, one, two, three. We'll be right back. So I read that, and Leroy Cooper, the baritone player, leaned over to one of the reelettes, and he said, "That boy is serious." So now Brother Ray comes in, and he sits down at the piano. And oh, when they had me play an electric song, Jumping with Symphony Sid, and I played a little solo on it, so rhythm changes. In New York, they called ice cream changes. So, you know. So I played some little, you know. And so now Brother Ray comes in, and he says, you know, we lost some of the music from the old days. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Do you know Hallelujah, I'll Ever So? And I did that, you know. Brother Ray starts laughing. Mm-hmm. And Joe Adams comes over and says, "Don, man, Brother Ray'd like to hire you." And I said, "How much does it pay?" And Joe Adams said, "Well, it pays $200 a week." And I said, "Well, I'm really sorry." I said, "I just came off the road with the Everly Brothers, who have just broken up in England." Mm-hmm. And I said, "And they paid me $225." And Joe Adams said, "Well, we'll have to call you." So now I'm going down the stairs going, "What in the world did I just do? I just turned down Ray Charles. What?" And I got in my car, and I thought, duh. And I'm driving home up to Las Palmas in Hancock Park, and Mom's out on the lawn waiting for me. Joe Adams called, "They're hiring you." And they gave me a separate envelope with the $25 so the rest of the band wouldn't see that I got a little bit more. But I went with Ray Charles. I was there for 10 years. I made recordings with Ray. We went on the road. Very interesting, going on the road with a black orchestra after you've been on the road with the Everly Brothers in the South. Mm-hmm. And everybody is all, "Y'all come back, we love you," you know. And now I show up in what the black musicians call the Chitlin Circuit with Brother Ray. I'm the only white person in the entire crew. We have the Fifth Dimension is traveling with us, the Raylettes, the whole big band, and me. Mm-hmm. And this was 1964. How are we doing on time? We all right?
We're okay. You're
good.
Okay.
1964, and the Civil Rights Act had just been passed, and the three kids had been killed in Mississippi. And so we show up, and we're in Montgomery, and Governor Wallace had said, "Segregation now, segregation forever." And we get on the bus. We had an airplane. We have the Buzzard. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we land the Buzzard. We get on a bus. We're driving down the road toward the Coliseum, and we notice there's barbed wire all the way around the Coliseum. And there is, about every 3 feet, there's a trooper with a shotgun. And we're going, doesn't look good. So now they flag down the bus. They stop us. And they get on the bus, flashlights and shotguns. And Brother Ray yells, and I'm sitting right behind Ray. Brother Ray yells, "What do they want?" And Jeff Brown, the road manager, said, "They want the white boy." He said, "Governor Wallace has decreed that no white people will be allowed at the Ray Charles concert, and we want the white boy." Well, we knew what that meant. That meant that I would never be seen again. Mm-hmm. And Brother Ray shot right back at him, telling me Spanish. I had a little mustache, and I had my guitar on my lap. I was ducking behind it, and I started speaking high school Spanish to Lily Fort. She said, I said, "Señorita," I said, you know, "¿Cómo estás?" And she says, "Don, what is wrong with you?" In the meantime, these ignorant crackers are up in the front of the bus discussing, am I white or am I Spanish? Well, they finally got off the bus, and we drove down into the Coliseum, mm-hmm. and the Raylettes and the Fifth Dimension came right into the men's dressing room and started putting makeup on me, and they darkened me up so we could play the concert. And we got the hell out of Montgomery, Alabama. But that night, Ray Charles saved my life.
Yeah, no, that's, oh God, I can't believe that they would try to kill you to play guitar.
You betcha.
Now, let me ask you something about playing with Ray, because mm-hmm. you were playing with a big band, and, mm-hmm. and you did kind of his pop hits, but you were doing big band stuff, and some of the stuff that you were doing is that rhythm type of thing.
Right.
Is very, and I know from working on playing big band charts, the guitar was the timekeeper,
yes.
and the drummer did the accents.
Right.
So you did a little bit of both, I would assume, with Ray.
Right.
So you were the timekeeper for the whole band.
Well, the drummer. And the drummer.
Really?
And Wilbert Hogan was the drummer in 1964.
Right. Yeah.
And Hogan was a jazz drummer, very serious. These men were all very serious. Their life mm-hmm. depended upon playing right.
Mm-hmm.
And one night, we were backstage, and all of a sudden, promoter comes up, and he says, listen, Hogan, we're going to have, I want you to wait for this one. They said, we're going to have a comedian. And he said, I want you to get out on stage and play some pratfalls. And Hogan walked right up to him, and he looked him in the eye, and he said, I don't play no circus drums. And the promoter kind of went, ooh, and disappeared. We never saw that guy again.
We're getting close to the end, but what I want to mention is I wanted to talk. You were the staff guitarist for Motown,
right.
which is an unusual position.
It was a great honor for me.
But you defined, with the other musicians that you played with, you guys defined a style that's legendary. Can you break it down a little bit and tell us what that was? I mean, what is the Motown sound? How would, as a guitar player, how would you play that? Or,
well, first of all, the Funk Brothers in Detroit started this.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to give homage to the Funk Brothers.
Okay.
In fact, my show at Bogey's on the 20th of this month is featuring two legacy Motown mm-hmm. people, Lamont Dozier Jr., whose father, Lamont Dozier Sr. from Holland, Dozier Holland, wrote all those hits for Motown. Mm-hmm. Beth Griffith Manley. Beth is a daughter of Johnny Griffith, Funk Brothers pianist. And I was an artist on Motown, although most people don't know that. I was on a group called Odyssey.
Oh,
and
wow.
I was actually a recording artist on Motown for a year till the group broke up and Donnie Dacus went on to be with Chicago and Royce went his own way. But this is a Motown show. And when you ask about what defines Motown, the amazing things they came up with. Now, I come up in Los Angeles, 1969. Diana Ross comes in with a little guy, about 11 years old, great afro, was Michael Jackson. And Freddie Perren had written this unbelievable arrangement, and Louis Shelton was the guitarist on top. And so he had octave, A flat, and he went... Right? The piano glass, bow, rump. So it's down. In the meantime, I'm looking at my part, and I'm an octave above the bass. Wilton Felder played the bass from the Crusaders.
Mm-hmm.
And so it went bow, bow. And then David T. Walker. And so there were three of us, and that was the sound. The same in Detroit. There were always three. And they always made jokes at Motown because there was always a white musician somewhere, and they would call it the Oreo. You know, they had the white guy
right,
in the middle.
Yeah.
So anyway, so now we're making these records for the Jackson 5, and we did ABC, and we did, you know, we did Stop the Love You Make, and I, you know, that's that thing where it's I can't remember right this second, but anyway, so we made these records, and a lot of times we made stuff up, like Marvin Gaye, Let's Get It On. I made up the lick at the beginning of Let's Get It On.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do it on this guitar. But
what guitar did you use for those sessions?
Well, that guitar is now in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. It was a Crown guitar. It was a copy of a Barney Kessel Gibson.
Mm-hmm.
And I put light strings on it. And I'm a big B.B. King fan. So I was very much into that. And Renee Hall, the arranger, knew that. So when they're doing the Renee made that up, and I can't do it on this guitar, but it's at it. I guess I can. I moved the bridge.
I heard it move.
Yeah. But anyway, so sometimes we'd make it up. You know, when you listen to... that stuff is genius.
And basically, you would just have a chord chart, and
yeah.
you guys would just do your stuff.
Or in the case of Freddie, he wrote it out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that line on I Want You Back was written out. And the same with ABC.
Was there that much difference between the Motown sessions and the Wrecking Crew sessions? Because a
yes.
lot of that was improvising, too, right?
It was, but like Loving Feeling, you know. what I had was... And to be able to play steadily, that's what that was about. And you get five guitars doing that, it's magic.
Yeah.
And yeah. two piano players and three, you know, three bass players. And oh my gosh, off we went.
And all you guys were really tight, so it's like
oh, yeah.
really just...
And
were...
you know, when the disc jockeys, Phil was very smart. You have lots of loving feeling. The backside is called Tedesco and Pittman. And it's a jazz blues. Because he didn't want the DJs starting to play the B-side.
So he purposely...
Yeah, but when they first put that on, and it was a 45 RPM, and when Bill Medley says, you never... You know, the DJs thought it was at the wrong speed. They were like, oh my gosh, this must be a 78. And so it was a lot of confusion.
Yeah, that was a different... That was a big... I mean, there was nothing like that
nothing.
That came out at that
nothing,
time.
Nothing. And then, you know, then we recorded River Deep, Mountain High.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the last great song. You know, the last wall of sound, you know. And then, you know, I can't sing Tina's part. But anyway, we did. So that was River Deep, Mountain High, a huge hit in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Phil went over and started working with the Beatles in the UK.
Mm-hmm.
But not a big hit here. And it was a tragedy. I was heartbroken. I love Phil. Mm-hmm. I've known him since I was 19.
Wow.
He gave me my first T-Bone Walker album. You remember this? Remember T-Bone when he goes... and he goes... T-Bone.
That's just great stuff. Now, how would you describe... You did a lot of stuff there in the 60s, besides Jan and Dean, Mom and the Papas, Beach Boys.
Partridge Family.
Wow. You did the television.
No. I played on a lot of Partridge Family. I played on the Monkees, where I arranged and played guitar on several of their hits. Mary Mary, Gonna Buy Me a Dog, Sweet Young Thing, You May Just Be the One. We actually were on stage with the Monkees one day, but they had a curtain. It was called a scrim. You know what a scrim
yeah.
is? Where it doesn't show light through. And it was me and Jerry Magee and Ray Pullman. We were playing. The Monkees weren't playing.
Mm-hmm.
That was the original, you know.
When you guys were playing with the scrim, was that the time when Hendrix opened?
I don't remember.
Because he opened for them once.
Did he really?
Like,
oh my God!
Because all these little kids and their parents brought him. And he's out there and he's doing all the stuff with the guitar,
licking his guitar.
Yeah, it was interesting.
And he sets it on fire.
Yes, but like with the Monkees, no, that was you. So yeah, they're a lot of their stuff. How was it doing the sessions? How were those?
Well, it was wonderful. Mike Nesmith is a really good musician, and Peter Tork also. But
they didn't play on it, right?
Well, Peter played on some. Mike Nesmith played some rhythm guitar. But most of all, we collaborated, and we did the arrangements together. And it was all very musical and wonderful and very friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a great time.
That's great. No, that's amazing. But that was all those sessions. I mean, you guys were doing different stuff that was just part of the whole body. Because, you know, look at all that listing of those different groups. Totally different sound. Mamas and the Papas. Totally different than the Monkees.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. And of course, Jan and Dean. And Jan and Dean and the Beach Boys were friends. And they would sing on each other's songs. I don't know if you knew that. They sang background for each other. And it was a wonderful time. I mean, I remember seeing Mama Cass the last time I saw her. The corner of Ventura and Laurel Canyon, where the car wash was, at Dupar's was. And you'd go upstairs, the stairs at Dupar's, and you could look out the back window, and there were cottages. It was like a motel. And Mama Cass was gassing up her big Cadillac, and I was gassing up my Volvo. And she said, hey, Don. I said, hey, Cass. And God forbid, you know, she passed away a couple of weeks later.
Wow.
I mean, who knows?
Great singer.
I loved her great singing. Human being.
Yes.
See, that's the deal. That's the deal. Sonny and Cher, I mean, Sonny was wonderful. He was just... Oh, do we have time for The Beat Goes On?
Yeah, go ahead. Okay, we have a couple minutes.
Okay. Sonny comes in, and the first time I met them, they were Caesar and Cleo. And we played a song called Baby Don't Go. And I did this little... I improvised a little thing. A week later, Atco signed them, and they became Sonny and Cher. So now we're recording. Now Sonny starts having sessions. And he comes in, and he has this thing, and it's... going, uh-oh. Turns out, Carol Kay says, wait a minute, try this. And she goes, and we're all going, and that was The Beat Goes On. Well, Barney and Howard Roberts, I mean, these are jazz guys. These are, oh my God, chord changes guys. And to sit on E7th, or it was an F, and Barney finally says, oh, Sonny. And Sonny is in the booth. He pushes the button. Yes, Barney. And Barney says, Sonny, if a doctor told me I only had 2 weeks to live, I would rather spend them with you because each moment is like an eternity. And Sonny says, gee, thanks, Barney. And there we went, man. That was The Beat Goes On.
The Beat Goes On. Wow. Well, we're out of time, and we didn't even touch. We just touched the surface. I have to have you come back.
I'd be honored to come back. I would love to. You'd be here, too.
Yes. And just to let you know, if you want to hear, learn more about Don, www.donpeakmusic.com. And, Lori, thank you so much for introducing me to Don. Hold on, let me get your mic on there. But go ahead and announce he is playing.
Yeah, so just to reiterate, Don has a show at Bogey's in Westlake Village, and that is on the 20th of this month.
Thursday night.
Yes, Thursday night, couple 8
p.m.
weeks from now. And Lamont Dozier Jr. sings, and it's an all-star lineup there. Just fabulous. It's called Generations of Soul.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a lovely place to see a show. It's intimate. It's up close and personal. And Don speaks and tells some of his stories. And you should go.
Thank you,
and
Lori.
And then one other show that's coming up at the tribe that I'm part of is doing for hurricane relief for Hurricane Matthew is at the Eastbot Lounge, which will be in 2 weeks on Sunday, October 23rd. And it's just going to be a wonderful chance to give to the victims of Haiti, which we're in the process of putting together just a big contributory event and just donating money and playing lots of great music to do that. So hope you can make it to the Eastbot Lounge, which is upstairs from Vitello's Italian Restaurant in Studio City.
I'm going to go ahead and we're going to close the show with a clip from a Don's trio. And if I remember correctly, I'm looking really quick in my notes. The name of the trio is the is it the Generations?
No, I just call it It's About Time.
It's About Time, and that's the name of the album.
Right.
This is from It's About Time, and this shows more of the jazz stuff, and this is called Honeysuckle Rhythm. Everybody, have a great week, and we will see you next week. Thank you again, Don.
It's
Thank
my pleasure.
You, Lori. Everybody,
you.
Have a great week. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.